There has to be some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have a car stopped at 10th and Grant's bike by there.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD. Folks, today we're going to cover a case, Scott Peterson, who was the school resource officer at Parkland School in Florida, when 14 students were killed and three staff members in what we know across this country as a definition of being of an active shooter. And school resource officer Scott Peterson, basically, he's been accused in not so kind terms of being cowardly. They actually call him the coward of Broward, and Parkland School, of course, being in Broward County. And in an unusual set of circumstances, unusual because this is the first time, I believe, across the nation, he's actually being charged as a school resource officer. He's been arrested and he's going on trial for child neglect, which is quite unusual because they'll have to prove that he failed to exercise due care. And even in the legal definition, that these children who lost their lives were under his care to be able to be convicted of child neglect. Now, these cases are really have caught the not just the imagination, but the hearts and the minds of the American public, because we view the police as protectors. And when they fail in that capacity, we view it as cowardice, basically. We expect the police. They raised their right hand and swore to defend the Constitution of the United States. In this instance, swore to defend the Constitution of the state of Florida. And they swore to protect the lives and the property of people under their care. Now, a school resource officer is a very specific job. And Officer Peterson, he had 30 years on the police department in Parkland down there. And out of those 30 years, 25 of them, he served as a school resource officer. Now, those of us in the police service, we would consider that job to be what's called a detail, a job where you'll have weekends off. There's no heavy lifting, almost no danger in that job whatsoever. But there's a certain skill set, in essence, that is necessary for a job like that. But certainly, a school resource officer would not be viewed at all by other officers as a warrior-type cop. And we'll define what warrior is, warrior versus guardians. There's two definitions in the criminal justice world of who cops are expected to be these days, warrior versus guardian. And most politicians, most community members would prefer police officers to be guardians, in essence, to work with the community, not to fight crime directly or to fight crime and risk their life, but to work within the community, more of a political-based type of thing. And a lot of real, well, what I call real cops, the warrior types, they disagree with that, and that's not who they want to be. They want to fight crime, take it head on, and they want to fight against the criminal. And they're willing to put their lives on the line to accomplish that goal. Whereas the guardian type of officer is more the mellow type cop. And, you know, people will probably get killed for saying this, but that's okay. I've seen this in my 27-year police career. Many people that are in details are almost off the street community affairs, school resource officer, highway safety. They were not go-get-em type cops. Maybe there were some reasons other than that they took these jobs. Maybe they needed certain hours for their family to be able to take care of their kids, or for their wife to work a job and them to go home and take care of the kids, that type of thing. But in the police service, it becomes apparent that there are certain officers on the job that maybe they don't even take the job as seriously in regards to crime fighting. You see officers that allow themselves to get grossly obese, get grossly out of shape. To me, they didn't take policing seriously. And they didn't take it seriously to the fact that one day you may have to save your own life with your own physicality, and you weighing 100 pounds more than you should weigh is not going to help to save your life. But let me not get on that. That's a whole other subject. Let's talk about Scott Peterson and what he did and how this sort of opens up the door across this country for officers to be charged with a crime, basically for failure to act, for failure to do their job. And to help me explain this tonight is retired NYPD sergeant, professor, law degree, professor at Albertus Magnus College in Connecticut, the always affable Mike Geary. How you doing, Mike?
Good, Billy. Thank you for having me on tonight.
You know, Mike, I think this is a great case for you to talk about, because there is a legal aspect of this, but there's also the policing aspect. And I'd like you to define those terms, warrior versus guardian. And you've heard that a million times in the criminal justice field, right?
Yeah, there's always been that argument in the NYPD, and I'm sure in many other police departments, many, especially city agencies, you know, big city agencies like Chicago, LA. What kind of policing model do you want? Do you want the cops to be aggressive, to go after the small stuff in the hopes that, you know, by fighting crime at the lowest level, as you see the broken windows theory, that you therefore reduce the instances of disorder, and that leads to a lowering of the instances of crime. And you go after panhandlers aggressively, you go after people hanging out on a street corner late at night aggressively, you go after people drinking in parks, you know, fare beaters on subways and buses, you do all of those things, and you look to seize the people, you give them summonses, you run their names through a database to see if they have a warrant on them, and you go after them. And when you're going after guys with guns in the street, you go after them in mass, and you go after them very aggressively, get them as many as you can, as quickly as you can, off the streets. Because many of these people who are carrying guns, obviously they're carrying guns not for nefarious reasons. Many of them already have prior felony arrests, have done time in prison. And if you make, you know, a couple of hundred of these arrests every year, maybe a couple thousand of these arrests every year, you will reduce very drastically the instances of crime. And we saw in New York over the course of many years, from 1992 to 2002, crime go way down, dropped from over 2,000 homicides a year down to like 400 homicides a year. And that's incredible. And that's what the warrior type of police officer does. Guardian officers, we see that nowadays in New York and many other cities, the politicians and the public does not want to see aggressive policing in their neighborhoods. They don't like the optics. They don't like the politics of it. And they would rather talk about what they call the root causes of crime. The root causes of crime, like poverty, joblessness, discrimination, and things like that. Things that society needs to handle, and that is far out of the purview of the police department, so that the police officers only do what is absolutely an emergency, and everything else, they just lay back and let other agencies work it out, grassroots organizations, other city agencies, and they sit back and they don't aggressively attack the perpetrators of crime, but they sit back and just be a part of the city landscape. And that's how we see it in the NYPD. There might be a technical glitch, Bill. Um,
So, Mike, I'm sorry. Stupidly of me, I didn't add myself to the screen. No wonder you're not very good. What I wanted to say, and I don't know whether you agree with me or not, it's whether or not you consider a school resource officer, not a warrior type cop. Definitely a personality type, that specific personality that chooses that job, usually a mellow type of guy.
Yeah, very well.
Has a graduate degree, but definitely not what we would call a street cop. And I don't think I'm, I don't think I'm moralizing about this. I don't think trying, but I think that's the person who it is. So when a school safety officer is thrown into a combat situation, out of 30 years on the job, 25 he was a school resource officer, he's not ready for it. He is absolutely not ready for it. And in policing, all of a sudden people get surprised. Oh my God, he didn't go in there. Well, dude, it's not like you put, a green beret as the school resource officer. You put a mellow type guy, and that's what you want. You want, we talk about warriors and guardians. You put a guardian type in that job. And probably that's the person who is most suited for this job. A guardian type, not a warrior, because a warrior would be bored to death doing this job.
Right. A warrior in a school setting is probably going to be a recipe for disaster, because a warrior type of person with that warrior mentality is going to want to stop every kid from smoking anything. They're going to get involved in every single dispute that's on the campus. They may end up, when we see this, I know in my own state of Connecticut, where I teach, that there's a has been for years tremendous disagreement between, do we want aggressive policing in the schools to stop fighting and assaults and to look for guns? But if you do that, because there is a safety issue in a lot of these schools, like in Bridgeport and New Haven, if you do that, you are then going to have school resource officers stopping and frisking people looking for weapons, and they're going to be very aggressive. And the kids aren't going to like it, and the parents aren't going to like it, and the politicians aren't going to like it, and school officers aren't going to like
it. You know, Mike, and they don't want that inside a school.
No, they don't.
I remember one time we set up in a on a school in East Harlem that had these two thugs robbing everyone in the school. Mm-hmm. And their MO is that they would rob kids out on the street and run back to the school. So we just set up in the school, and here these two little robbers did about their 10th robbery, and they come running to the school. And we hooked them up. We put the cuffs on, and the principal started yelling at us that we cuffed these two little thugs in the school. And I assured the principal, if he protested too much, he would be cuffed to them. I think he shut up after I said that, but he was very aggressive with us. And I said, you better back off, or you're going to be cuffed to them. You're going to go with them to the precinct. I just want to play this video. This is unusual from a legal perspective, that Officer Scott Peterson, a 30-year veteran of this police department, is being charged with child neglect. And really, in the words of the parents, they call him the coward from Broward. So let's play a little bit of this.
This morning, the former sheriff's deputy and school resource officer accused of standing back and failing to confront the gunman during the 2018 Parkland, Florida school massacre is preparing for his trial, set to begin next week.
Mixed emotions. You know, it's tough.
I wouldn't want any law enforcement officer in this country to experience this.
Scott Peterson faces multiple counts of child neglect for not entering the building where the attack was unfolding. 14 students and 3 staff members were killed. First order of business before the trial, jury selection, and a key decision by the judge whether to allow jurors to visit the school, which is still preserved as a crime scene. Peterson's lawyer wants jurors to hear what he describes as an echo outside the school, which he says factored into Peterson's decision to take cover during the shooting.
The only way to appreciate that is to physically be there.
Legal analysts say this is a first of its kind case, applying child neglect charges, viewing a school resource officer as a caregiver.
Have a difficult case here. It is not an open and shut case. There's a lot open for interpretation.
Meanwhile, 1,400 miles away in Texas, tomorrow marks 1 year since the Uvalde school massacre, where 19 students and 2 teachers lost their lives. Uvalde's mayor yesterday acknowledged the lingering questions about the delayed law enforcement response that day.
We realize you still don't have the answers that you need, and it frustrated all of us. For that, I apologize.
He says officials are close to finalizing an agreement that would allow the city's investigator to access police records to determine if any officers should be disciplined. And Uvalde's mayor also says plans are moving forward to demolish the crime scene. Rob Elementary.
Hi, everyone.
Rough.
So, Mike, crazy, right? I mean, but to tell you the truth, look, I sympathize with this Officer Peterson, but all bets are off once there's a gunman killing kids. And what was he protecting outside? The air? The people that you needed to protect were in the school. So that alibi or the defense you're coming up with that he didn't know where the shots, please, you belonged in the school where the shooter was. If the echoing was happening, you were hearing it, that, dude, please, I'm not buying that crap, you know? And the parents, you know, of course, they watch their children get slaughtered, and then this guy doesn't go in the school. And it hurts me to go against law enforcement and to say, no, dude, I don't care what your defense is, and he's acting as if he's the one that is put upon here. But, dude, you didn't do your job. You could have saved lives that day, and you chose to stay outside. And I'm just going to make one quick observation. There is no worse thing for a cop than to be accused or to be looked upon by your peers as a coward.
Yeah, Billy, I remember just going back quick to talk about real quick about Columbine in the 1990s. Years ago, if you had a confrontation in a school where there was a gunman with a firearm, what happened in Columbine is the responding officers went there, realized there was at least two shooters, and they called for backup, and they waited to go in until they had superior numbers and that they were ready. And by the time they went in, the shooting had all been done, and the Columbine shooters had committed suicide in the school library. And so by the time the cops got there, the shooting was all over. It was a mess. And after that, in policing circles, there was a sea change of thought. And the idea was that you would not wait for heavily armed officers. If you were by yourself, even if you had a six-shot revolver, you had a Glock, you know, with maybe 15 rounds, a 9mm, you had to go in. You would not wait. And so from the 1990s onward, that was a thought, and that's how police departments trained their deputies in cities and in counties all across America. You went in and you confronted the gunman as quickly as you could, do the best you could, and while, you know, the backup is coming, but you go in there first to try your best to neutralize the threat with whatever, you know, resources you have, a 9, whatever, an AR-15, if you've got that, something, bulletproof vest, Kevlar helmet, whatever you got, you go in as fast as you can. He didn't do that. And as much as I understand, there probably was some echoing. The fact is, he actually stayed outside for over 40 minutes. Now, we could all say, okay, maybe he's not the best tactician. Maybe he was outgunned, but you have to go in there. You have no choice. He stayed out, and he might have saved 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, who knows how many students. Maybe he would have saved the majority of those people. Maybe he would have saved a dozen people's lives that day. Maybe only one. We don't know. But he did not do the sort of engage in the sort of response that all officers throughout the country knew that you did post Columbine High School back in the 1990s. You went in as fast as you can, did the best you can. You did not wait for backup. You had to confront the gunman as best you could.
Mike, this is as you started talking about Columbine.
Oh, the library.
I had some file
as many people
here
as they possibly could. So they had a host of weapons. You know, they had shotguns, they had the rifles. In addition to that, what they caused most of the devastation with was the cricket bomb. So as they walked, they would strike that cricket bomb and throw it. And as it went off, certainly shrapnel will go in every direction. If you watch the footage, you see them go up down the stairs to the cafeteria, shoot back up the stairs. So people had been shot or shot at in every location.
Jefferson County 911. Yes, I am a teacher called by high school. There is a student here with a gun. The school is in a panic, and I'm in the library.
We were being told there was 9 shooters dressed in different attire all across the school.
See, Mike, this is very early on in these things, and police weren't trained the way they are now is to in and confront, because they were concerned. Also, there were booby traps. There were bombs. They didn't know where the bombs were placed. They were concerned with multiple shooters. But these days, the training is you go in, you confront, you neutralize, you take out the shooter.
And a lot of that was a result of them moving up and down and firing in every direction. When the bomb went off in the cafeteria, the fire alarms went off, the sprinklers went off, so the rooms were flooded, all the doors shut, they locked. You know, I'd prepared my entire career for being in firefights. All I could think was, I'm going to get blown up going through this window. It was so loud, so chaotic in there. The first room we came into the cafeteria, we had to break the door open, and the children were frozen. It is the first time I'd seen this phenomenon, and it's just sheer fear. And I said, let's go, we got to get out of here, and no one would move. So I finally reached down and grabbed the first one and just picked him up and pushed him, reached down to grab the second one. By that time, the third one was starting to move, and we'd yell, go, 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 and move them out. Every room we broke into, I assumed we'd be in a firefight. And then finally, we worked our way up into the science room. They had went upstairs. They got in a shooting with the teacher, Dave Sanders, as he was trying to clear out the students. What a hero, you know. So there we are holding bandages on him, trying to keep him alive. He went from talking to us to barely breathing in a matter of minutes. And Dave wanted his wallet out so he could see his family. You know, what a hero, and I'm glad I got to, you know, spend his last moments with him.
Yeah,
heartbreaking, you know, and this is one of the earlier cases that sort of defined United States as a nation police response to active shooters. You know, El Guapo, you made a very excellent comment in the chat. I'm going to read it. Whether Peterson has a warrior spirit or not, he should have thought through about the possibility of facing a situation like this before he applied for the job. His failure to go in is inexcusable. El Guapo, I agree with you 100%. Right. You know, it goes back to the same thing I said earlier in my mini monologue, was that, to me, how dare cops get fat and out of shape when they're on a job like that? Because now, to me, you don't have respect for yourself, because it's going to come a day in your 20 years, your 25 years, your 30 years, where you're going to have to protect your life or someone else's life. And if you're grossly obese and out of shape, you're not going to be able to do that. So I think that people that take policing seriously, they have to understand what the potentialities are and what's the worst case scenario. And surely this, for Scott Peterson, was the worst case scenario. Mike.
Yeah, Bill, look, not everybody's expecting, no one's expecting Scott Peterson to run through, you know, bust through doors and guns blazing like it's some sort of action movie, you know, that sort of thing, superhero action movie. But they did expect him to do was to confront the gunman, you know, right first radio for help, figure out where possibly where the gunman is, and go there as fast as you can. With what he's got, with what equipment he has, whether it's, again, like a 9 or an AR-15 or 6-shot revolver, do the best you can. If all you could possibly do is to exchange 1 or 2 shots with this person, try to confine him to one part of the building while other people remain safe, you know, so that you could confine them to one location where they can't move. They know you're there. If you could do that, he would have been a hero. But the fact is, he stayed out and he never actually went in. I, as much as my heart goes out to him, and that's a cop's worst case, you know, worst nightmare. You have to do something. You have to move. That's what you're trained to do. And that's where I think the public is so, you know, really angry, is that he actually didn't move.
No, he, you know, something, as I said, to me, he was protecting the air out there. So I don't really buy it. Let me play a little bit of this file tape, add it to the screen.
Scott Peterson, he was the Broward County Sheriff's Officer. He was assigned to that school as the school resource officer. And during an interview with reporters last week, he said the public needs to know that he believes he did everything he could on that fateful day. Well, jury selection is expected to start on Wednesday, and Court TV's Julie Janae gives us a look back on what happened in February 2018, on that day that left 17 people dead.
I'm Scott Peterson. I've been a police officer for 30 years. I've been a school resource officer for 25 years.
On February 14, 2018, Scott Peterson was the school resource officer at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School when 14 students and three faculty members were fatally shot by the Parkland school shooter. Former Deputy Peterson claims he did not charge into the school during the six-minute massacre because he believed the shots were coming from outside.
And one of the things that will shock everyone out there is we have 22 witnesses listed who say that they heard the same shots my client did and were 100% certain that they were coming from outside of the 1200 building, and specifically from an area that some people think were hundreds of yards away.
Dear Mike, does that make any sense whatsoever?
No, it's what a defense attorney has got to go with, because He's got to use some sort of defense, and his client's entitled to that defense. But even if you thought the gunman was shooting from outside, which means that it's probably someone with a sniper rifle, you want to go into that school to make sure students are okay in the school. So I don't think it holds any water whatsoever. I don't think it'll sway the jury much. At all.
No, I don't either. Let me play a little more of this.
In Broward County, Florida, Peterson stood outside of the school building for 4 minutes armed with a handgun. Some of the victim's family members label Peterson as the, quote, coward of Broward.
To be honest with you, I'm not shocked. You can tell that guy had no heart. Two guys who had a lot of heart were Coach Feist and Hickson. They went in there without a weapon. And this guy is sitting outside hiding, and he has his gun drawn, hiding.
I wouldn't want any law enforcement officer in this country to experience this.
I work with some of the bravest people I've ever met. One person didn't do what he should have.
This chief is a known dirtbag. He really is. I've seen him on. It's disgraceful. Even though he may feel this way, he threw his guy under the bus without 1 second of thought.
Done. It's horrific. The victims here, the families, I pray for them every night. It makes me sick to my stomach that we had a deputy didn't go in, because I know if I was there, if I was on that wall, I would have been the first in, along with so many of the other people.
Prosecutors claim Peterson's actions show he was aware the shots were coming from inside the building and could have prevented some of the shooting if he had confronted Nicholas Cruz. Cruz pleaded guilty to the 2018 Parkland massacre back in October of 2021.
How do you wish to plea?
Guilty.
I accept your plea of guilty.
Then, after a three-month sentencing trial in 2022, a jury of seven men and five women decided the shooter would get life in prison instead of the death penalty.
Mr. Cruz, you are remanded to the custody of the Department of Corrections to complete the mandatory life sentences imposed by the court.
Scott Peterson retired shortly after the shooting in 2018 and was fired and charged retroactively a year later. Peterson is currently out on bail and facing seven counts of child neglect and three counts of culpable negligence for the 10 people Cruz shot on the third floor of the school. Six of them were killed after Peterson arrived at the building.
I want the truth to come out, and if it's going to be through a trial, so be it. I'm eager. I think, you know, not only people in Florida, the country, most importantly, the families, they need to know the truth of what happened, because unfortunately, it's never been told.
Still with me, criminal defense attorney and civil rights attorney KC, or early
Mike, well, you know, the thing is, this is a landmark case in regards to a police officer being charged with child neglect. And really, the charges are based on failure to act.
Right. Yeah, the state of Florida, you know, as many other states, you have your child abuse, child neglect statutes, like here in New York, and you have mandated reporters like teachers, nurses, doctors, you know, school counselors, all of these people who are supposed to take some sort of action if they see neglect or abuse taking place, or they believe that it has happened to the child. You know, police officers too, you have to, if you come across an abused or child or neglected child, you have to take them into custody. We did that a number of times in the police department. I personally did that a number of times. What's kind of unique here is that the theory that he had a duty to protect those children, and that duty meant that he was supposed to go into that school, and therefore his failure to go into the school was actually failing to carry out his duty. And so it's unique because we've not seen police officers, you know, held criminally responsible. You know, you could always sue a police officer in a police department if you feel that someone like a child has been abused or suffered abuse after the police officers were already notified. And they were negligent in their discharge of their duty. But this is the first time that we're seeing this where in an active shooter fact scenario.
Absolutely. Lieutenant Peter Pranzo, an NYPD Hero Street Crime Lieutenant Medal of Valor recipient. The lack of combat training and the lack of violent interactions can foster an officer who will freeze during an actual combat incident. Lieutenant Pete, you're 100% correct. And I blame that on, as you do, the lack of training, the lack of combat training, because the truth is that police departments, everyone wants to feel fuzzy and good, and they don't like the warrior mentality. They want the community policing type officer who's the feel good type officer, work with the community, stop. Do not confront criminals, you know, just get them after the fact, after they destroy neighborhoods and kill people and rape and maim. You know, we don't want the warriors anymore. The warriors are too effective, you know. So it's really disturbing that that is the view of most police departments, because it's almost like they would rather, you know, criminals get away with their crimes than officers confront these same criminals. Cheryl, thank you for the $279 super sticker. Very much appreciated. Guys, these cases are very, you know, some of them are landmark. And last year, we saw, it's been a year since the Uvalde shooting in Texas. And I'm going to play a little bit of that in a minute. But at first, I just want to say, folks, this is Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. And if you like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, what are you waiting for? Go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, ring that bell, make positive comments, make any kind of comments. We love to read your comments. If you want to support us financially, we have a Patreon with three different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel memberships. You see the folks in the green font, they're part of our YouTube channel, and we have five different levels for that. Those are our friends, our fans, our subscribers, and we appreciate them greatly. So, going, just segueing from this case, and this is a landmark case because, oh, by the way, if Officer Scott Peterson gets convicted of a felony in this case, he loses his 30-year pension. Retroactively, I don't know how they do this in Florida, but said they retroactively fired him, because in New York City, if you put your papers in to retire and it's approved, you got your pension.
That's right.
And whatever happens after that is, you know, but if it's not approved and you get convicted of a felony, I believe they can. Is that correct? They can take your pension?
Yeah. In New York State, a conviction of a felony is automatic. You lose your job. You lose everything. Yeah.
So, I mean, as much as I feel for Officer Peterson, I just think this is almost an instance in policing that is unforgivable. It's really unforgivable. And I think that his punishment, I think, will be living with himself and actually realizing what he did on that day. Mike?
Yeah, the broadcast that showed the first clip, the lady asked, rhetorically, did he do all that he could do? And I think my heart goes out to Officer Peterson, but I believe that he did all that he himself was capable of doing. He didn't have the heart to go in there into that school. He couldn't do it. And that's where there was a failure. He should not have been perhaps given that job. Perhaps he should have been retired a long time ago, but he had a duty to take certain actions in certain situations with training. You know what these actions are in the different scenarios that you're exposed to in training. And he himself could not do it. And he froze. And that's part of human nature. And that has happened, you know, in policing and police departments too. But the problem is he didn't freeze and fail to chase a robber who just robbed a drugstore, something like that, and they got away with some money. He froze during a combat situation involving over a dozen children, being killed by the gunman with an AR-15.
There was a total of 17 people were killed in this instance. Mike, when you talk about that, the Uvalde case was a whole systemic failure of an entire police department. Let's play a little bit of this.
Well, the first detailed investigative report into the mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde is finally released. That report describing a series of shortcomings and failures of the school district and law enforcement officers who failed to prioritize saving the lives of innocent victims over their own safety. Waiting 77 minutes to confront the gunman as he took the lives of 19 children and two teachers. ABC's Maria Viriel has the latest from Uvalde, and we want to warn you, the video is quite disturbing to watch.
Oh, shots fired! Get inside! Go, go, go!
A first-hand look at the Robb Elementary School shooting just minutes after the suspect made his way inside, firing more than 100 rounds in 2.5 minutes. The city of Uvalde now releasing body camera footage after a new report found systemic failures in law enforcement response. Just 5 minutes after the shooter first walked in, at 11:38 a.m., a school district sergeant walks out to relay information that later turned out to be wrong.
He's on inside this building. We have him contained.
But the suspect was inside room 111 and 112 and still shooting.
Am I bleeding? My wife's bathroom.
Officer Ruben Ruiz is inside the hallway responding while his wife, Eva Mireles, a teacher, is in room 112 texting him. She would not survive. Now, nearly 8 weeks after the murder of 19 children and two teachers, the city promising transparency as the first comprehensive report investigating officers' response reveals widespread lapses both before and during the killing spree. The damning 77-page report from the Texas House Special Committee noting that despite 376 law enforcement officers on the scene, there was egregious poor decision-making on all levels.
Mike, that is like, I've covered this case when it first happened, and they had all the heavyweights of law enforcement across the nation commenting on this. Bill Bratton, Ed Davis from Boston.
Boston.
All the premier police commissioners across the nation. And they were horrified. They were just horrified, A, at the lack of training, but mostly what they said was a failure of leadership.
Initiative, right?
Well, leadership of the leader. But, you know, I said also, look, in an instance like this, we as law enforcement officers know that you are only required to obey lawful orders. Mm-hmm. So if I was in a hallway and I hear kids getting shot and some empty suit tells me not to go in there, I'm not listening to him, even if he outranks me. I'm disobeying those orders because that's not a lawful order. You cannot order me to stand down when kids are getting murdered. You cannot do that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there's so much went wrong there. They initially were there in a fairly quickly, because it is a very rural area, but the initial good response, where they, you know, some people had, some of the children probably were already deceased, but the initial good response was totally, and the momentum was totally lost, because they tended not to do anything, waiting for some other order from up top. But as you know, in the NYPD, and maybe we're different from a lot of other police departments, but you know, you and your partner, just think of the partner you have. You could confront almost any situation if you have two good cops working together with plenty of initiative and plenty of common sense between their brains. The shooting's going on. You're not staying outside that door. It doesn't matter who is giving you an order not to move. You have to move. That's something that has been ingrained in police culture since the 1990s, Columbine. Absolutely, that's the way you have to go. And what they did was the failure to supervise, the failure to take action, resulted in more of the students killed than ultimately would have been had they taken some initiative. It's a total black eye for policing, and it's kind of inexcusable, because we could, you know, the public will forgive a lot, but the public expects that police officers will move forward toward danger and will try their best to,
to confront it. Yeah, confront it.
Absolutely.
Danger. Let me play a little more.
The report says if you're not willing to put the lives of the people you serve, of those children, before your own, in my view, you should find another job.
The rampage lasted 77 minutes until Border Patrol agents breached the classroom, killing the gunman at 12:52 p.m. School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo testified that they prioritized getting children evacuated over approaching the attacker. My thought was, we're a barrier. Get these kids out.
We need to get these.
That's a horrific training. That's poor training, horrific leadership. And maybe it was his defense to this, but he's a poor leader. And you can see he has horrific training, because no one told him to do that. No one trained you to do that. What you were trained to do, or should have been trained to do, was to confront the shooter. End of story. Right. You know, when they talk about, even let's go back to Columbine, some of these poor kids bled to death.
That's right.
SWAT wouldn't go in. But back then, that was the training they received. No, don't go in, because you could run into a booby trap that could make it worse by going in there. That's not the case anymore. Training to confront an active shooter across this nation is confront, and terminate the shooter.
Right. Yeah. The chief there in Uvalde, you could walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, the shooting is going on. The kids can wait a few seconds, okay, to move now, because that's going to be a slow, time-consuming process. You can walk and chew gum. You can figure out what's going on. You could run towards that gunman. And as you are running towards that gunman, you're protecting all the kids behind you. You're getting two for one there. So his statement that he was thinking, oh my goodness, I got to get the kids out first. Hell no. Where he got that training or how he thought of that, I'm shocked.
Absolutely.
It's very shocking.
Come on, kids, come on.
While officers evacuated students, Chief Arredondo tried to talk to the gunman.
This could be peaceful. Could you tell me your name? Anything I can know, please?
That gunman firing 142 rounds, the majority before any first responders even entered the building. But there were still survivors in the classroom while officers waited outside.
Child on the phone, multiple victims. A child just called if they have victims in there.
Now, can you imagine that? A child calls them, we have victims. You're not booming that door? Are you kidding me? First of all, if I was there, say I was a sergeant on the scene, I wouldn't even be able to hold back ESU. It's like the pit bull on the chain. They would have been booming that door So this is despicable to watch. It's despicable to hear. It's really, really, and I'm sure there's some great officers on that scene, but there was some really poor leadership here. Really poor.
Yeah, and it went on and on and on. Now, who knows how many would have been saved? Maybe two or three students would have been saved and not killed. It still would have been a horrific sight. However, they did not take the initiative. The supervision wasn't there. It was very laid back. When you see the chief yelling to the gunman, "Can we talk, please?"
After he's fired 142 shots, you want to talk to him?
Please?
I think all talking is over. The talking is going to come at the end of a muzzle, you know?
Right. That's it. Shocking. Very shocking.
Dispatch heard telling officers there were survivors, but it would be at least 47 more minutes after the first 911 call before they finally went in. The committee stating, given the information known about the victims who survived through the time of the breach and who later died on the way to the hospital, it is plausible that some victims could have survived if they had not had to wait 73 additional minutes for rescue. The report also found a breakdown of school safety measures, the school's alert system delayed due to Wi-Fi issues, and none of the three exterior doors to the school's west building were locked, giving the shooter unimpeded access. The committee confirming he walked inside room 111 through a door with a lock that had been broken for months. A possible motive also released in the report. The shooter was a former student of Robb Elementary School and attended fourth grade in room 111. His former teacher testified he was bullied that year. The mother of Rogelio Torres, one of the fourth graders killed on that day in May, continues to fight for accountability and change.
That's what I'm here for, to fight for my son, fight for the other kids, and fight for the teachers that lost their lives that day.
Maria, joining me now live from Uvalde for more. Gosh, Maria, just watching the top of your piece.
So, folks, we know this is probably the blueprint for what not to do during an active shooting. This is probably the worst police response in the history of the United States to an active shooter. If you want to look at a blueprint, again, of what not to do during an active shooting, this is it. This is the blueprint. And, and then we talk about Nashville, Tennessee, which was the blueprint for exactly how to handle the situation. And I just want to make, I'm going to show you some of that in a minute, but I just also want to say that all these instances, everyone, of course, criticizes the police response and whether it's good or bad. But these two officers, at least two, more than that, in Nashville, were incredible heroes. Yet, were they called into the White House to visit the White House? Were they honored as heroes throughout this? No, they weren't. It was like, it's like expected of you, a day's work. And, you know, go about, I don't think anyone even knows their names, you know. And look, policing can be a very lonely profession, and people don't do it for attaboys. You know, we used to say, you know, you did something good, attaboy, attaboy. They would hit you on the back, you know. And my favorite NYPD police department expression of all time is 100 ah shits. No, excuse me. What is it? What 1,000 attaboys don't equal one ah shit. So in essence, you can make a mistake, ah shit, and that is what you will be remembered by, not the 1,000 attaboys that you received. And it's so true. It's a profession that's unforgiving, like some other professions. Maybe medicine's that way. You know, you make one mistake, that's what you're going to be remembered for, not the 1,000 things that you did that were good. So I want to play a little bit. This was the Nashville active shooter, and these officers were just tremendous, tremendous.
The city of Nashville has released new information about the Covenant School shooting. Investigators have found that the shooter, Audrey Hale, acted alone in writings found in her vehicle and later at her home. She documented her planning of this massacre over a period of months. Those documents are under review by Metro Nashville Police and the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit in Quantico, Virginia. Officials say they still do not have a definite motive for the shooting, but do say that Hale studied the actions of other mass murderers. The investigation also found that Hale fired a total of 152 rounds, 126 from a rifle and 26 from a 9mm handgun. As seen in the dramatic body camera footage, two officers fired on Hale. Officer Rex Engelbert fired four rifle rounds, while Officer Michael Collazo fired four rounds from his 9mm handgun. The exact motive into this shooting remains under investigation at this time. Again, six people, three adults, three children, just 9 years old, were killed in that incident at the Covenant School in Tennessee just 1 week ago today. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are calling for tighter school emergency measures following that deadly shooting. The measures are gaining support as they sidestep any political gridlock on the gun control debate. Fox News correspondent Kevin Uretsky has more from New York.
Students across Nashville rallied at the Tennessee State Capitol Monday morning to demand stronger gun laws. Organized by the anti-gun violence group March for Our Lives, the students plan to walk out of their classrooms at exactly 10:13 a.m. to mark 1 week since Nashville police received the first call about an active shooter at the Covenant School. Six people died in the shooting, including 3 9-year-old children. In the wake of the tragedy, state legislatures across the country.
Well, this becomes the narrative after every active shooter, and whatever your political views are on gun control, on the Second Amendment, I think we all agree. I guess I should never say that because all people can never agree on anything, but most people agree that there should be background checks of people purchasing guns. At the very least, certain things should preclude you from owning certain weapons or buying certain weapons if you have a mental illness, obviously. There's some obvious things. However, I think that the politics of the Second Amendment is somewhat where the rubber hits the road and where no one can agree on the things that that would work in regards to preventing and vetting and terminating active shooters.
Yeah, Billy, if you look at the Tennessee video and you watch from the body cam of the two officers, and I've seen it repeatedly, what stands out is you could see their training. They're leapfrogging each other, clear left, clear right, clear forward, clear back, go green, stop red, that sort of thing. Their training is excellent, and they carried it out in a very disciplined manner, and they got to the gunman. Audrey Hale very quickly, and while the shots were still being fired, they didn't hesitate. Every time they kept moving forward nonstop, and they're doing it in a very organized manner while and going, not just recklessly running, but checking out each and every room as they're going down the hallways. That was excellent, disciplined response, and it was fabulous. And so that's where fairly frequent training comes into play. As Pranzo said, this is important. The training is absolutely important. You got to train people for those scenarios. It's expensive, it's time consuming, but you have to do it on a fairly frequent basis so that it becomes instinctual for people to do this, to do it that way.
Mike, I agree with you 100%. Training is one of the most important things in the police service. However, politicians talk about training, they give it lip service, and then they don't provide the money for it. They don't provide the funds for it. So it's very popular to talk about training after an incident. But day to day, when police departments need to live with their members and need to live with officers' lack of training, and it's evident in situations like this, the NYPD just made it not a requirement for new recruits to finish the mile and a half run. That adds to the fat people getting on the police department out of shape. People, why are you lowering the standards? You should be keeping the standards as they are or raising them, because that's inexcusable. So don't talk about training and then you're going to bring on more fat people. And I hate to use that term, but you don't belong being out of shape and fat being on the police department or the fire department for that matter. You need to be trained. You need to be in shape. You talk anyone in the military, you think anyone would get through boot camp and they'd say, oh, you don't have to run the mile and a half. You ate too much ice cream last night. Are you kidding me? It's like not even it just flies in the face. So as we're hearing this training, we need more training, at the other side of the coin, they're playing against the training, and they're letting people come on the police service who are unqualified, unfit, and unable. This is one of probably the worst shootings. And this is the Sandy Hook case, which is just so horrific. The kids were under five, I think it was 16 five-year-olds.
Yeah.
Just incomprehensible. And I'll tell a story about this once I play a little bit of this.
Safe. The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history, at least 27 dead, 20 children, 7 adults, including the principal. And the gunman killed himself. And all over this town, in churches like the United Methodist Church behind us, well, the lights are on and they are still open for prayer tonight.
And they will be all night. People have been gathering here for prayer to lean on each other and lean on a belief in something bigger than themselves to help get through what is just impossible to believe here or anywhere else. The sentiment here echoed in what you're seeing now down by the Washington Monument in D.C. Many members of the Connecticut delegation was there. But this story is really about their home here, Newtown, Connecticut, just 27,000 people. This is a place where people know each other. Families know each other. And what happened today is known by all. And it's not just about how many were lost. It's about the age. What is hitting everyone so hard is the reality of these being children that were targeted by a madman. We now know his name. We know he's 20 years old, Adam Lanza. We know that before he came to this school, he shot his own mother, Nancy, in the face, killing her at her home. The looming question is why this man then decided to come to this school. He shows up at a place where they're making gingerbread houses in preparation for the holidays and Christmas presents. Just kids. A man in black enters with a vest and multiple weapons and begins a massacre. It was a clear, crisp, and trouble-free start to the morning at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Kids like Ella Seavers and her mother Amy,
just do the elf dance, but you don't
eager for the weekend and the holidays to arrive.
It's Christmas time, right? Where are we, Mom, in terms of Christmas planning?
Some shopping, cookie making. We decorated our Christmas tree.
Ella, Christmas list made? Sent to Santa?
Yes.
Ella's class was preparing to make gingerbread houses.
When you first got there?
When I first got there, it was like a regular day.
But at 9:41 a.m., the children's day and their innocence is shattered.
6-7 Sandy Hook School. Call is indicating she thinks there's someone shooting in the building.
We heard a loud bang. We thought that something fell. Then we heard another. And then we thought that that was a gunshot.
What do you remember?
We got to school. We did everything we needed to. And then we heard all this racket. Then we heard them say, go on your cubbies. We thought we had to go because something bad was happening.
What did the teacher do then?
She read us some books and we talked about things and they played little games in there.
And while that was going on, your teacher was reading you books and keeping you calm?
Yeah.
She just kept her calm and told you a story?
She read us The Nutcracker and another book that was about Christmas.
Right. How did you find out, Amy?
Well, we got a phone call from the school saying the schools were in lockdown.
Lockdown? I mean, what sense does that make to you as a word for your kids' kindergarten through four school?
Not very good.
It sort of gives you the chills, just hearing hearing that and knowing what happened. And I was incorrect. 20 five-year-olds were killed and 7 adults at this. Well, They're including Adam Lanza's mother, who he killed before he committed this carnage at Sandy Hook, and then he killed himself. So it could have been 25-year-olds and 5 adults at the school, Adam Lanza's mother and himself. I would never count the perpetrator as one of the people that killed. That should be a separate category. But the chief, when I was teaching at a college in Westchester, the chief of Sandy Hook came to the school and he gave a lecture and he was unbelievable. What I unfortunately I don't have his name right now, but it was several years later, and I asked Chief, I said, how are your guys doing? And he said, very tough psychologically. They've had a really tough time dealing with this. And he spoke about, guys seeing 25-year-olds dead of gunshot wounds in a school where you're not supposed to see things like that. And he was an incredible man. And I hope that the officers, as well as the families from Sandy Hook, have gotten some help. And you never get over, I'm not going to say get over anything like this. You'll never, ever get those images out of your mind for the rest of your life, you know. But we have to have a serious conversations in this country about things like this. And this probably was, to me, you know, one of the worst, or the worst one, because of the age of the kids involved. Just totally horrific. Let me just go to a quick commercial, Mike, and then we'll come back. We'll come back to this. It's a little tough now anyway. Folks, if you're looking for a great attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer, an outstanding defense attorney, and a big supporter of Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. If you want to contact Joe, you can call him on his cell at 718-514-3855. Email him at joe@jmurray-law.com or go on his website at jmurray-law.com. Joe Murray, a huge supporter of Police Off the Cuff. You know, Mike, it's, you know, we started out this show, of course, talking about Scott Peterson, and that's the school resource officer from Parkland, and the fact that he's going on trial. Basically, for, you know, even though the charge would be child neglect, I think it stems from failure to act,
right?
And that's where it's coming from. And you know, the stakes can't be any higher. You know, you're a police officer, you're the out there to protect and serve. That's, you see, that used to be on the side of the radio cars in California, protect and serve, right? What is the dopey expression on the NYPD cars these days? I can't even think of it now. There's some stupid community policing saying, you know.
Right.
But I thought protect and serve sort of said it all. But as a police officer, as a law enforcement officer, you have to take that seriously and realize there's two types of cops, warriors and guardians. And you, if you're a guardian type, you may be called upon one day to be a warrior because you raised your right hand and you swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of whatever state you're a police officer in. Mike, this was a little tough. You know, when you cover stuff like this, it gets you a little bit emotionally. I want to get to you and your final thoughts, Mike.
Yeah, it's tough. In the police service, you don't want to ever accuse someone of failing to act properly, because you don't know how you yourself would act when the crap hits the whirling propellers. And in this case, Scott Peterson did fail to act. And we say that with a heavy heart, because all was required of him is to try to do something to mitigate the danger, to go into that school. We're not asking him to be John Wayne, you know, that's some sort of action hero, but to go in there and do the best that he needed to do. Maybe he did the best that he could do, but it was far below the best that he needed to do in that situation. And I say that again with a heavy heart. But, you know, this is human nature, and this is policing today, because we are going away from that warrior mentality everywhere. And it's going to cost us. And we can, and this sort of thing will happen again. I guarantee it will happen again. I'm sure there'll be many excellent responses to these sorts of shootings, as we saw in Tennessee, but there will always be that Uvalde type of response, or the type of response here in with Scott Peterson. And police officers pride themselves on their ability to just run towards the danger. That's why you become a cop, because you want to protect, you want to serve. You would run past another officer to get there before they did, because you want to be the first one through that door. So this is really hard. It's hard as a parent to see, to be reminded of all these school shootings, but it's also hard as a professional to see this sort of policing response to something that, police confront, every day across the nation. And the training has to be there to ingrain them the warrior mentality, even in those guardians. They have to have that warrior mentality capability when the chips are down.
100%, Mike. Very well said. You know, what you said, something that rang a bell in my brain, or set off a light bulb. And you said that, police officers are expected to run towards danger when everyone else runs away from danger. And I remember when I was a young anti-crime cop, I saw this guy on the street pull a 12-inch knife and put it to this woman's back. And he yoked it to the ground and ripped off her $5,000 fur coat, took it off her back. And I was at the light with my partner, and I ran out of the car. And I was like, police. And he ran up West End Avenue with this 12-inch knife in his hand. He dumped the fur coat. And we caught the guy. And I asked him a question, because I was in plain clothes. I said, how did you know that I was the police? And he says to me, because most people run away from robberies. He goes, you were running toward it. That's a badge of honor from a bad guy telling me, I knew you were the police because you ran towards danger. You didn't run away from danger. And so you rang a bell, that sort of little light bulb in my head. Folks, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. It's a little bit tough of a topic to talk about. And again, I feel for Officer Scott Peterson. I think he was in a bad situation and perhaps not suited personality-wise and training-wise to confront that situation. And, we'll see. His trial, I believe, may start tomorrow. I think as soon as tomorrow. So we'll see what the outcome will be. And this could have ramifications for the entire police service across this country, and in the statue of failure to act. And that's a real tough thing to have someone accuse you of, failure to act, right?
That's right.
Well, great. Thanks again for tuning in. This Police Off the Cuff Real Crime Stories. Have a great night, and God bless.
Good night, everyone. One episode, just ain't enough.